Thanks, everybody. It's great to be here with you today. I appreciate what's already been said, and I agree completely. And I see that there's a continuity between the martyrs of the past and the brethren of today. I, with Butch, am confident that there are a number of people in this room at this moment who would be willing to stand against that wall and be shot for their faith in Christ. We strengthen one another as we receive strength from the Lord. And one of the most difficult things in life is to maintain the attitude that some of us have right now and to be a living sacrifice. Sometimes it would be easier to be a dead sacrifice than a living one. I very much appreciate what's already been said. Oh, I should show you that picture that I couldn't find yesterday. I found it right after class. And it's not all that important, but those are two of Alexander Campbell's daughters. The one on the right is Virginia, who was a very good friend of C.C. Moore. And the one on the left is Decima, the girl he fell in love with and was engaged to. She broke off the engagement, and some people think that's connected to the fact that he became one of the best-known atheists in the country after that. At any rate, that was yesterday's story. I was reminded by Marty yesterday after class about something that Raccoon John Smith met when he first met, that he said when he first met Alexander Campbell. He and some of his friends had gone a long, long way to hear Campbell speak. Campbell spoke on the fourth chapter of the Galatian letter, and afterwards somebody asked Raccoon John Smith what he thought. He said, well, that was really great, but this was a long way to come to hear a man talk for half an hour. They said, check your watch. And it had been a 2.5-hour talk on the fourth chapter of Galatians. This was also the occasion, later on, John Smith said that at that occasion when I first met Campbell, I wanted everybody to leave me alone. I just wanted to stare at Campbell for an hour without anybody saying a word to me. I don't think he ever got the chance to do that, but he was enamored of Alexander Campbell, and there were a lot of people who were that way. We were talking a little bit about Barton W. Stone yesterday, and there are a few more things to say about him. A popular preacher, Presbyterian by the name of James McGreedy, came to the area where Stone was as a young man. Stone listened to him and didn't want to be moved, but he was moved by what he heard. He resisted for a while, but later he decided that he wanted to be a Christian. But one of the things that Stone was bothered by considerably in the Presbyterian theology was that, according to Calvinism, the Holy Spirit worked on the sinner apart from the Word to get the sinner so that he could be in a position to accept the gospel. In other words, you got faith because the Holy Spirit operated on you to give you faith. And Stone just never could, throughout his long life, he never could buy that. He couldn't understand how or why God would choose to give faith to some people and not give it to everybody. He also was convinced when he started reading the Bible that having faith in God is something that he could do, something that we could do, that I could do, that every individual can do. It's not just a matter of sitting around waiting on God to act on you before you can become a Christian. Faith comes by hearing the Word of God. So Stone was a great deal bothered about this issue for a long time. And after Stone felt like he had been converted, he went to David Caldwell, who had been his teacher. We ended talking about Caldwell yesterday, I think, and talked it over with him. Stone said, I don't know whether I should be a preacher or not. I'd like to be, but I can't buy everything that they're saying. And Caldwell encouraged him to go ahead and become a preacher, and later Stone did. He came out of Caldwell School about 1794. He'd gone there in 1790. And he went down to Georgia and taught down there, and then he found his way up to Virginia again and went around several different places. Some people came through on a wagon train eventually and said, up around Bourbon County in Kentucky, it's a great place to live. The ground is rich. It's bluegrass territory. And they suggested he go up there. And about that same time, he got a letter from a man who said, we need a preacher at Cane Ridge. And we had a preacher up here at Cane Ridge. He built us a nice log meeting house, but the problem was he liked his corn in liquid form. So we had to get rid of him, and we need you to come. So Stone went up there to Cane Ridge and began preaching there in that little meeting house that you can still see if you go to Cane Ridge today. There's a new stone building built over the top of it to protect the old log meeting house from the elements, but the log meeting house is still there. And Stone was developing pretty well by this time. He divided his time between Cane Ridge and a place about 5 miles away known as Concord. He established a school at Cane Ridge and had several young men in the area attending it. As Stone studied the Bible more and more, he found more and more things that were wrong with the Presbyterian Confession of Faith that he just honestly could not align himself with. In 1797, he went to James Blythe. He said, "If I stay in this system, I've got to get my ordination as a preacher." He already had his license, so you could get your license and you had a certain amount of time to get your ordination. But he said, "I just cannot agree with so many things that they say." Blythe said, "Don't worry about it. I don't think you're going to have any problem. There's some latitude allowed." So Stone went on with the examination, and when they asked him if he believed in their confession of faith, which was a question they always had to ask to every prospective Presbyterian minister, he said that he subscribed to it insofar as he saw it consistent with the Word of God. And they accepted that. They went ahead and ordained him. But his studies of the Bible continued. In 1801 came the Cane Ridge Revival. This is on your sheet for those of you who are looking at that occasionally. It's one of the most famous religious events in the history of our entire country. It's estimated that 25,000 people came to that meeting at Cane Ridge. Consider this, the population of the state of Kentucky at that time was 250,000 people, only 250,000 people. So this is 10% of the entire population of the state of Kentucky. Stone did a lot of preparatory work for this. This revival occurred in August of 1801. Wagons came in droves, loaded with people, loaded with food, and all during the days of this meeting, there would be men speaking at the same time. There were no amplification systems, and so they would be separated from each other by an appropriate distance so that their voices wouldn't interfere with each other. They'd stand up on tree stumps or make little stands, however they could. You'd have a Methodist over here and a Baptist over here and a Presbyterian over here, all of them talking to a few hundred or a few thousand people at the same time. And it was a very emotional experience for these people who had a hard life on the frontier, lived under rather repressed circumstances, and it was an emotional release for them. People, they thought they spoke in tongues, they got the jerks, they barked the devil up the trees, and had all these sorts of experiences. 30 years later, Stone wrote about this in the Christian Messenger, which was his paper, and he said that what we preached, all of us together, was that it's within our power to accept the gospel of Christ. Now, that's not Calvinism. And he knew that they would get in trouble because of this, in trouble with the leading religious authorities, and they certainly did get in trouble over it. Stone had longtime enemies because of this. But eventually, as Stone continued to study, he concluded that sprinkling was not baptism, only immersion is. Ultimately, he was immersed himself. Stone had bought a farm out between Concord and Cane Ridge. He lived on that a while and they sold it. Later he bought another 120 acres for $30 an acre near to Georgetown. Later he sold that and moved up to Jacksonville in Illinois in 1834. He got married about a month before the Cane Ridge Revival. Several children were born. Most of them died very young. Infant mortality at that time was very high. The mortality for mothers was very high at that time. His wife died in 1810. Stone married again. His mother-in-law said, "Well, if you'll just come down to Tennessee and farm my farm for me, I'll give you another farm." He went down there and worked for his mother-in-law long enough to know that she wasn't about to give him any farm. In 1816, he got letters wanting him to come to Lexington, Kentucky and start a school. He went back there and he saw what the brethren promised him there was not going to hold true. He went down to Georgetown and taught school there and established a congregation. Moving around a lot, lived there until 1834. Then he decided to go to Jacksonville, Illinois. Jacksonville is 55 miles from Alton up Highway 67. He didn't stay in Kentucky, but he did love Kentucky. He loved the Southern hospitality, the Southern words, the Southern thoughts, and many of the Southern ways. He wanted to continue to live in Kentucky, but Kentucky was a slave state, and Stone did not believe in slavery at all. Sometimes somebody would give one of Stone's children a slave for their birthday or something like that. There would be a slave on his property. He didn't want that. His mother-in-law bequeathed 7 slaves to his wife and his children in perpetuity. They were bequeathed forever. He could not, therefore, emancipate them. So he decided to emancipate himself and his family from them by coming to Illinois and living in a free state. Picked Illinois because of a man by the name of D.P. Henderson. Henderson had gone to school at Transylvania and moved to Illinois to the old Diamond Grove area outside of Jacksonville. He came back home to that and said, "Brother Stone, that would be a good place for you to go." Stone had baptized Henderson in the Elkhorn River near to Georgetown in Kentucky. He'd known him a long time. So Stone decided to move to Illinois, but he was miserable living around Jacksonville. He didn't know anybody. They didn't know him. They were a different kind of people than he was used to. Jacksonville and that area was largely settled by people from New England. They weren't as friendly. They weren't as kind-hearted as the people from Kentucky, Stone didn't think. And he was probably right about that. Stone hadn't been there very long before. He really wanted to go back home. Well, the financial panic of 1837 came along. Stone put his farm up for sale, but he couldn't sell it, and so he was stuck up there. He didn't know what he was going to do about it. He wrote a letter to T.M. Allen. Allen lived over in Boone County, Missouri, outside of Columbia. Allen had several slaves. He was a very wealthy man, a good farmer. Stone had converted T.M. Allen back in the old Berean congregation in Fayette County, Kentucky. And Stone said, "Brother Allen, I want to come to Missouri. You've got the kind of people there that I'm used to." And that was true. Missouri was largely settled by people from Kentucky who were largely themselves transplants from Virginia. So there was a southern spirit in Missouri. T.M. Allen was a level-headed man, and he sympathized with Stone. He told him, "Yeah, I wouldn't live up there where you're living for anything, but I love Virginia, I love Kentucky, and I love living here in Missouri because I've got those same kind of people with me." So Stone said, "I want to come down to Boone County." Well, he couldn't sell his farm, so he couldn't buy another one. He never did make that move. In 1841, Barton W. Stone suffered a stroke. His entire left side of his body was paralyzed. He couldn't talk very well. He was very unhappy. He worked on that stroke following the best instructions that the doctors could give him. Slowly he got better. In a couple of years, he was able to use a cane, but he was still partly paralyzed, even though he could get around. The brethren in Kentucky were wanting him to come back there. In the summer of 1843, he made a visit back to Cane Ridge. He visited Charles Moore's mother, who, remember, was his daughter, was Stone's daughter, and on the old plantation. He visited his daughter there. And I don't know, maybe you'd have to be an older man like me and Barton W. Stone to really understand how it felt to be back home among old friends. Have you noticed a lot of times old people, they move back to where they were originally from, even if they've been away from there for 50 or 60 years. They'll move back to where they were originally from. There's something about being back home, and it really touched him to be back at Cane Ridge and in Kentucky. He was a very happy man. He went out to Cane Ridge and spoke. A 12-year-old boy who was afflicted and was in a wheelchair came forward and was baptized during Stone's meeting there. Stone was remembering the revival of 1801 and so many other things of the past. All that was very precious to him. Barton W. Stone had a son named Barton Jr. Barton Jr. was with Stone on a part of this trip, and when Stone went anywhere, he leaned on Barton Jr.'s arm. At Cane Ridge, they left the meeting house one time, went next door to a house with a white picket fence around it, and in this white picket fence, there was a white gate in the fence. They started through that gate, and suddenly Old Stone stopped and looked around. He was always a sentimentalist. He stopped and took his cane and stamped with it on the ground and said, "This is where I had my stand." He was remembering the revival of 1801. There'd be, as I said, several preachers speaking at the same time. Sometimes they'd make a little stand out of any logs or lumber that they could find so that they'd have a place to stand and a place to lay their Bible. And as he went through that spot where that gate now was, he realized that that's where he'd had his stand 42 years before. The old memories all came flooding back to him. As the summer went on and he'd gone back to his place in Jacksonville, he bought that farm when he first moved up there. They'd established a corner on one corner of that farm. They'd established a congregation. It was called Antioch, as most of the followers of Stone called their congregations. Wherever Stone's people went, they tended to establish churches named Antioch. They loved that name. It was there that the disciples were first called Christians, and the name Christian was very dear to Barton W. Stone. There must have been 100 Antioch congregations at one time, congregations of the Church of Christ that were called Antioch at one time in this country. The first name of some of the places that I work now was Antioch, Bramer, for instance, up about 80 miles north of Kansas City. The first name of that church when it was started in 1875 was Antioch. Most of these were started by people who either came out of Kentucky themselves or were related to people who came out of Kentucky. 1844 came, T.M. Allen wrote to Barton W. Stone wanting him to come to Missouri and speak in October. Stone wasn't feeling very well, but he went down to Boone County, Missouri, and spoke, preached his last sermon at Bear Creek, just 3 miles north of Columbia, Missouri, on October the 21st, 1844. He started back home. Along the way, he got to feeling bad. He had a daughter who lived up in Hannibal, Missouri, on the river, and her married name was Bowen. He detoured to go up there. He stayed at her house, had a lot of visitors there. Jacob Kreft Jr. was there. And on Saturday morning, November the 9th, 1844, Barton W. Stone died with his head on the shoulder of Barton Jr. Stone never had been a good manager of money. He just never seemed to be able to figure out how to handle it or to spend it wisely. If he got into any kind of a business transaction, he was more likely to lose money than to make it. He was just the opposite of Alexander Campbell in this. Barton W. Stone's wife was a petulant complainer who cried a lot. She was always bemoaning her situation. Barton Jr. was not the man that his dad was. He was just as petulant as his mother. He was always dissatisfied, and he kept feeding this dissatisfaction back to his mother. So the whole bunch of them were pretty unhappy together. Barton Jr. got the idea that what they needed to do was print a biography of his father and sell that, and then all of them would have enough money so that they could have something. Trouble was, they didn't have enough money to print it. T.M. Allen got a letter from Barton Jr. It was a caustic, sarcastic letter accusing T.M. Allen of something that never had occurred. He didn't have any ill will against Barton Jr., but Barton Jr. thought he did. Allen didn't know what to do. He sent the letter down to Kentucky to John Allen Gano, and Gano then was put out with Barton Jr. Later, Barton Jr. went through Georgetown, went to the home of John Allen Gano. Gano sat him down and gave him a pretty straightforward talking to. They got their relationship somewhat straightened out, but the problem of the biography remained. They had asked Barton W. Stone during the final years of his life to write an autobiography, which he did about 1840. But he was too self-conscious about boasting to even do himself justice in what he wrote. He would pass over things in a sentence or two that really should have been elaborated on. So his little autobiography was very brief and didn't really tell the story. Stone's closest friend around Kentucky was John Rogers. I gave Dixie Rogers a couple of pages out of the Stone Campbell Encyclopedia the other day. She's going to look up some information about John Rogers and William Rogers and Samuel Rogers and see how they might be related to her late husband, Bill Rogers, whom a lot of you knew. He used to be a member of the congregation here. And that's going to be interesting to learn, if there is anything to learn about that. But John Rogers lived over at Carlisle. He'd been baptized by Stone in the fall of 1818, again in the Elkhorn River. The Elkhorn River to them was like the James River was here. There are people sitting here now still who were baptized down in the James River years ago. And they had a meeting at John Allen Gano's house to discuss this issue of the biography. They didn't know what they were going to do about this, but over a period of months, they developed the idea of printing the little biography that Stone had written and building a lot of other documents around it to tell the complete story. So they decided to go to D.S. Burnett up in Cincinnati to have this printed. Burnett gave them a price of $900 to print 1,000 copies. Seemed like an enormous amount of money at the time. John Allen Gano took the lead in this. He got loans from friends, and the biography was printed, but they never, ever recovered the money that they put into it. So again, Sister Stone was very unhappy, and so were the Stone children. Stone financially was just no Alexander Campbell. They were temperamentally opposite about this, as well as opposite in so many other ways. For example, Stone and Campbell had different views about what the name of the church should be. Stone had listened to Rice Haggard and had a long talk with him. Rice Haggard came through Fayette County, Kentucky as early as 1804. He'd heard that there were some independent Presbyterians around and he wanted to connect with them. He inquired after them and went out to visit one and had a long talk with Barton W. Stone. Rice Haggard had been a circuit riding Methodist preacher back in Virginia, but he'd given that up when he came in contact with James O'Kelly. There were so many strands of people wanting to restore. And James O'Kelly, Abner Jones, just all kinds of people that we haven't even had time to talk about. But he became a Republican Methodist interested in restoring New Testament Christianity. Haggard had sat at the feet of a teacher named Samuel Davies, one of the most powerful and eloquent of the old Presbyterian ministers. Samuel Davies had preached a long sermon on the sacred name Christian. Davies had gotten his sermon idea from an old Anglican bishop by the name of Grosvenor, who printed his sermon back in 1729. And so it goes. Rice Haggard went back to the book of Isaiah in chapter 56, chapter 62, chapter 65. You know these scriptures well. And he was convinced that God intended for his people to be called by the name Christian. Haggard convinced Stone that this was right, and nobody ever changed Stone's mind on it after he made it up. So as the years went by, Stone met Campbell. Campbell at one time had been just as enthusiastic about the name Christian, but he also pointed out that we were called disciples before we were called Christians. Campbell said, "The moment anybody proves to me that Paul and Barnabas by divine oracle called the disciples Christians, then I yield to that name as the exclusive name of all the followers of Christ. I will wear no other and will contend for one name as for one faith, one Lord, and one baptism." Well, after the union between the followers of Stone and the followers of Campbell, which took place in 1831, Campbell didn't even go to that, by the way. He was always dubious about Stone, I think primarily because Stone was an Arian. Stone believed that Jesus Christ is a created being. He did not believe in the deity of Jesus Christ. This was always something that Alexander Campbell could not understand, and I think he was always a little suspicious of Stone because of this. But the Stone people had been very evangelistic and had a great many followers, and it was felt like we have enough in common here that we could go ahead and unite. But Campbell didn't go to that meeting. That meeting, the Campbell part of that meeting was handled by Raccoon John Smith, who so admired Alexander Campbell. Anyway, Stone got a letter from somebody in Alabama, and it said, "We got a hymn book from Alexander Campbell, and the title of the hymn book is Disciples Hymn Book. How come?" Well, Stone didn't know how come. This had been discussed earlier. Should it be Christian hymn book or disciples hymn book? So Stone sent one of his former students, Leonard Fleming, on a trip all the way up to Bethany from Georgetown, Kentucky, to find out why the hymn book was called disciples hymn book. He got up there and Campbell said, "Well, we felt like we needed to get this thing printed and get it out. I didn't have time to check with Stone, so we just put it out." But he knew Stone was not happy with that name. Stone passed this occasion by, as his disposition was. In 1839, toward the end of the year, Alexander Campbell declared in the Millennial Harbinger that he wanted the brethren to be called by the name Disciples of Christ. Stone was hurt. "Why would Campbell do that when he knew how I felt about it?" was his question. He felt like Campbell was being uncharitable, and he also felt like Campbell didn't understand the Bible on this subject. So he wrote to Campbell, and they wrote back and forth about this. But it was always an uneasy union for Campbell. I think primarily because of Stone's Arianism. Campbell wasn't even sure, I think, how closely you should regard someone as a brother if he didn't believe in the deity of Christ. So he had problems of conscience there. And it was just the same kind of difficult situation that we face in our time as well. James Shannon, about 1853, denounced Campbell for what he'd done. John Allen Gano and T.M. Allen were at the old Antioch Church in Fayette County, Kentucky, when the Millennial Harbinger came that said they should be called disciples. Gano began to preach more fervently than ever, "Let's put our confidence in the Word of God and not go by what men think." So this was a disturbance among us and remained that way for many years. Eventually, the people who wanted to have Alexander Campbell as their founder of their denomination would call themselves the Disciples of Christ and use it in a denominational way. But those who were more like Stone would call themselves Christian, and sometimes that was used in a denominational way. By the time we come to the turn of the next century, in 1906, the United States Census Bureau, for the first time, formally recognized the Churches of Christ as a religious body distinct from the Disciples of Christ. The previous 100 years had seen the beginnings of the Stone Campbell movement in America and had witnessed the burgeoning of that movement toward becoming this country's largest indigenous religious movement. In 1809, Thomas Campbell had written the Declaration and Address, saying, "Where the Bible speaks, we speak. Where the Bible is silent, we are silent." The 1860 census listed 225,000 disciples in 2,070 congregations, number one in the growth rate in the U.S. They were one of the few religious bodies to avoid dividing over the Civil War, the slavery issue and other sectionalistic issues in the Civil War. The reason they didn't divide in the Civil War is because they had no earthly headquarters to divide. There was congregational autonomy, so where is the division going to come from? There had become to be two main thrusts, though, in this Campbell Stone movement. One of them, from the very beginning, was a project, as Alexander Campbell said, quote, "It's a project to unite the Christians in all the sects," end quote. That's the way Campbell put it. But the other thrust of the movement was to accomplish this unity through a restoration of the ancient order of things. The idea was that if we all go back to the Bible and accept it as our rule of faith and practice, we can unite on that ground. The first goal of the unity began to recede into the background after the Campbells rejected infant sprinkling and started practicing immersion. This was a stumbling block over which many people could not get, as we spoke about yesterday. Adult immersion was a formidable barrier to more people than it was not a barrier to. One way of looking at the difficulties we have had in this movement is to see the people then in two different camps. In the first camp are those who emphasize unity and seek it at almost any price. In the second are those who emphasize the restoration of Bible patterns, even if that means that some people leave. And usually those in the former category were described as liberals, and those in the latter category were described as conservatives. As that movement wended its way through the 19th century, it ultimately found itself facing really just a giant hermeneutical impasse pertaining to the authority of the Bible in its establishment of the parameters for the church, and whether or not it was biblically feasible to use instrumental music to have missionary societies such as the American Christian Missionary Society, which was established in 1849 with Alexander Campbell as its first president, although he didn't go to that meeting either. He stayed home in Bethany claiming that he was sick. Now, here's a guy who's never sick, but he claimed he was sick. And they elected him president of the American Christian Missionary Society in absentia. But the question was, are we only going to do what the Bible mentions for the church, or are we going to take the position that if the Bible does not specifically forbid a thing, then that thing is allowable? These two opposite attitudes were mutually antagonistic emphases, and they led to strikingly different methods and consequences. And eventually, after 40 years of discussing it from every angle under the sun, we just had to conclude that we were never going to agree on the philosophy. Because of congregational autonomy, there was no formal mechanism existing to pronounce a division. But as the 19th century neared its close, most local churches and most of the institutions that some of them had established and most of the periodicals that had been established aligned themselves with either the conservative side or the liberal side. The American Christian Missionary Society, when it was conceived and started, it caused everybody to be either pro-society or anti-society. You couldn't just ignore that the society existed. You've got to take a position on it one way or the other. Pro-society churches usually also used instrumental music, which was also first used around 1849. The formal split between these two bodies occurred at Sand Creek, Illinois in 1889 when Daniel Sommer spoke prior to the reading of the Address and Declaration. The Address and Declaration had the name that was just reversed from Thomas Campbell's Declaration and Address. This was the Address and Declaration in 1889, exactly 80 years later, reversing that name and somewhat reversing the intent of Thomas Campbell's Declaration and Address of 80 years earlier. And Sommer said that, speaking of the liberal people in the movement, that after being admonished and having had sufficient time for reflection, if they do not turn away from such abominations as the Missionary Society, instrumental music, and so forth, if they do not turn away from these abominations, we cannot and will not regard them as brethren. So that was in 1889. By 1906, the census wrote to David Lipscomb. David Lipscomb had been the editor of the Gospel Advocate for 40 years, since 1866. The United States Religious Census in 1906 wrote four questions to David Lipscomb. The first question was, is there a body called the Church of Christ as distinct from all other Baptist groups? And Lipscomb answered, yes, there is a movement at present which is simply trying to follow the Scriptures using scriptural ways and scriptural names. Second question was, do you have a headquarters? And the answer, of course, was no. The third question was, do you have distinctive principles? Lipscomb said, we are engaged in proclaiming the gospel of Christ. And the fourth question was, could you give us a complete list of all the churches, all the congregations? And Lipscomb said, sorry, not really. You know, because of our autonomy, we don't really know where everybody is. So the Churches of Christ and the Disciples of Christ were listed separately in 1906 for the first time. It's very difficult to get information or even cooperation sometimes in compiling information. In the 1906 census, there were in the Churches of Christ, there were 159,656 members listed in 2,649 congregations. In the Disciples of Christ, 982,701 members, almost a million members of the Disciples of Christ in 8,260 congregations. By 1916 census, it was sharper and clearer in its delineation. In the 1926 census, sharper and clearer yet. In the 1926 census, the Churches of Christ had 433,714 members in 6,226 congregations, while the Disciples of Christ had 1,337,595 members in 7,648 congregations. By the time the 1936 rolled around, the religious census in the United States was getting so little cooperation that the Census Bureau became disgusted and just quit having a religious census. Nobody was interested that much in it anymore. By 1970, the Churches of Christ numbered about 1.5 million members in about 10,000 congregations. And today, Churches of Christ claim over 2 million members, split up into a number of various groups. Generally, when we divided over the things that we do rather than over the things that we believe, because it's the doing that really makes it impossible for us to assemble together and work together. Large differences in belief have usually not divided us as long as these differences did not impact our working together. The other night, the example was used of having a kitchen or not having a kitchen in a meeting house, for example. Sometimes a congregation might meet for years, and in their situation, they don't have one, then they're building a building, and they have to decide to go one way or the other. Are we going to have a kitchen or not? You have to make decisions on these issues, but it is possible to work together because the kitchen and the building has nothing to do with what we do when we're in the assembly of the saints. That's how it's different from instrumental music. Instrumental music is right in the assembly of the saints. If it's against your conscience to use it, then how can you possibly meet with a congregation that's using it? Many or most probably of our congregations have people within them who believe that instrumental music would be okay, but as long as they don't push it, then there's no problem meeting together. We can still do that and sing a cappella. We're talking here about a group of autonomous congregations who accept the Bible as being true and a completely adequate revelation from God. Group of congregations who have a weekly observance of the Lord's Supper, baptism by immersion for the remission of sins, a cappella singing, voluntary giving, government by elders appointed according to the New Testament qualifications, these kind of things that you're also very familiar with. Yesterday, Theda wanted me to talk about Daniel Sommer, and I'm going to take the time to do that since Theda gives me cookies. And she knows how to put them on the lowest shelf. So I'll go ahead and talk about Daniel Sommer just a little bit here. Sometimes we're called Sommerites. I mentioned that a few days ago, and I'm sure there are those of you who've been called a Sommerite. Whether you knew what it meant or not, somebody thought they knew what it meant if they called you that. Daniel Sommer probably should be regarded as the last of the pioneers of the Restoration Movement. He was born back east from German stock, nominally Lutheran stock, in 1850, and he died in 1940. So his life spans 90 years. Alexander Campbell died when Sommer was 16. Both of Sommer's parents died in their 40s. Sommer's father was addicted to alcohol. He died at the age of 41 when Daniel was only 5 years old. This is one of the great reasons that Daniel Sommer always abhorred strong drink. He absolutely hated liquor because he said it damaged my father and impoverished my mother. Young Daniel Sommer did a great deal of work to help support the family, and when there was a teacher, sometimes he was able to go to school. When he was 15 years old, he joined the Methodist Church, but he noted that among the Methodists, the loudest were usually the least stable. In 1866, he first became acquainted with the Disciples of Christ, over time and through discussions, he became convinced that his infant sprinkling was not a scriptural baptism, and he was immersed into Christ in 1869 at the age of 19. And when he left Methodism, he really left it. He left everything in Methodism behind when he left the Methodist Church, left behind everything except for his zeal. He decided that he wanted to spend his life preaching the gospel of Christ. Local members where he was suggested that he enroll in Bethany College. I mentioned, and it's on your outline, that Bethany College had been started by Alexander Campbell at Bethany, Virginia, now West Virginia, in 1840. So Daniel Sommer hadn't even been to school for 7 or 8 years, and yet he went to Bethany College. He said, "Probably no young man ever went to college who was more ignorant than I was when I reached Bethany." He got there in 1870, just 4 years after Alexander Campbell had died, and he said the spirit of Campbell just pervaded the whole college and town. It was palpable, he said, even though Campbell had been dead already for 4 years. So he went more ignorant than most of the students who were there, but Daniel Sommer had learned the ways of hard work from childhood up. And he said, "I spent so much time at Bethany by lamplight with my books that my eyelids became sore." By constant effort, he learned quite a lot, and although he left without graduating after 3 years, all his life he relied on many things that he'd learned while he was at Bethany College. While he was a student at Bethany, he made a 7-mile journey over to Wellsburg to hear the speaking of Benjamin Franklin, who was the editor of the American Christian Review. Daniel developed a lifelong admiration for Benjamin Franklin. This is the preacher, not the statesman. He became Benjamin Franklin's protege. They remained friends for the rest of Franklin's life. Well, this is really one of the very most important relationships in Sommer's life. His father had died young. He did not and could not admire his father, who was a drunkard. And he kind of got under Benjamin Franklin's wing, and there was a sort of a paternal relationship there. Sommer eventually, in 1866, purchased and edited and published Franklin's paper, the American Christian Review. If you had an inclination toward being a big shot in the church all through the years, you had to have a paper of your own. This was the way you got your voice out. All of the most influential men that we're speaking of, almost without exception, were editors of papers. I didn't say that everybody who has a paper wants to be a big shot, but I think this was an important part of the thing at that time. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. But Sommer considered himself to be Franklin's successor as spokesman for the conservative wing of the movement. He changed the name of the paper to the Octographic Review, octographic meaning the writing of eight, the eight people who wrote the New Testament. So he called it the Octographic Review for a while, and then in 1889 he changed it to the Apostolic Review, and then from 1897 to 1913 it was the Octographic Review again, and then it was the Apostolic Review again, because he said, get this, Sommer said, that octographic is too classical for the common people. He must have been a very funny guy to say things like that. When he died in 1940, his family kept the paper and they changed back to the original name, American Christian Review, which continued on until 1965. I can well remember when the American Christian Review stopped. Sommer was very interested in the Bible and the church and stridently opposed all human innovations like the pastor system, Bible colleges, etc., etc. He could be a funny guy. He was a gifted mimic and did have a sense of humor, but he very, very seldom, if ever, used it in the pulpit. He gave what he called plain sermons, and there's a book of plain sermons put out by Daniel Sommer that you can still, I mean, it's not in print, but it's still available. You can still find it. He did tell stories in his sermons, but it was said that he never told a story that didn't fit, and he disclaimed any efforts to entertain the audience. In fact, if somebody told him that they enjoyed his message, he would say, "I didn't preach it for your enjoyment, I preached it for your good." Daniel Sommer was pictured on this screen on Sunday. He's evidently been here and worked at Nixa, as I understood what was said. But I'll show you, if I can find a picture of Daniel Sommer. I think we'll see him here. Sorry, I hope we don't go through the same routine with this we went through yesterday. Yes, here's one. This is when Daniel Sommer is 85 years old. That's a pretty good picture of him. But, yeah, I think he does. He was a very strong man. It's said that he could lift with one hand what it would take both hands for most men to lift. And he sort of, I think, prided himself on his physical constitution. He used to hold out his hand and say, that my hand's still as steady as it was 25 years ago. That type of thing. This was an era of time. It was before the burdens had been taken off of human backs and a man's physical stamina and physical ability. It meant more in that day than it does now when we have so many technological helps. So this was Daniel Sommer. He was a very interesting man. He possessed an excellent reading knowledge of the Greek language, but he did not burden his audiences with discussions of Greek terms. He evidently knew far more about it than he usually, at least, revealed in his sermons. You can notice in the notes in the margin of some of the published debates, for instance, he had written there. He had this information when he needed it. For instance, in a church trial at Shelbyville, Illinois, as the movement split, often in a community there would be a decision on who's going to get the building. Both sides were wanting it, of course. There was a church trial in Shelbyville, Illinois in 1906. He appeared on the behalf of the conservatives there as an expert witness. He occupied the witness chair during the trial for 7 hours. And the opposing lawyer asked Daniel Sommer, Solo is a Greek word, could solo include instrumental music? Sommer turned to the Shelby County judge and said, "Will you permit me to read my answer from the Greek New Testament?" The judge said, "Are you a Greek scholar?" Sommer said, "I'll let you be the judge." It's such a cool thing to say to a judge. From his Greek New Testament, Daniel Sommer then read and elaborated on all the passages in the New Testament that include the word solo. He was a very shrewd man. He was possessed of a very commanding personality. He spoke when he spoke with a spirit of finality. On every occasion, he seems to have left the impression that he was master of the situation, whatever the situation was. He made repeated references to his health and strength. And one time he got bitten by a mad dog. And he recovered, and later he based a book on that experience called Hydrophobia. Hydrophobia is the name that was used for rabies at that time. But he called this book Hydrophobia and Its Cures. And he then spun it spiritually by talking about people who are afraid to be baptized. They're afraid of the waters of baptism. Hydrophobia. So it was quite an interesting and, I thought, shrewd play on words. He called himself a soldier by nature and a preacher by conviction. And he unfailingly presented himself as fearless and indifferent to hardships and strong enough to cope with any situation, even though he didn't seem to hesitate to catalog the discomforts that he had experienced as a preacher of the gospel. But I'll give you one example of his will. When he was 89 years of age, he was on a train when he suffered a stroke of blindness. Undeterred, he proceeded on to his appointment in Pittsburgh, and relying on his memory, he spoke as usual. From there, he went on over to West Virginia, where he spoke for several days, all in a world of darkness, couldn't see anything. Friends persuaded him eventually to cancel his other appointments and to go back home. Returning to Indianapolis by train, Indianapolis was where his home was, and you can still see the house they lived in down on Udell Street. Returning to Indianapolis by train, he took a taxi to his house, deposited his luggage in the upstairs bedroom, washed up, went to the kitchen for supper, greeted his family, he thanked God for the food before them, and it was only when his hands were groping for the silverware that his family learned that he was blind. He was a man of indomitable will, and a very interesting man. There are a couple of biographies. He wrote an autobiography that you can read as well. Very interesting. I've got to move on here to the next generation, which I think it's important to consider and then try to bring our class this week down to a point. There's a little bit of difficulty with what I need to do now, but I believe enough time has gone by that we can have a sense of perspective and some degree of objectivity about what I'm going to say regarding Carl Ketcherside, who lived from 1908 to 1989, his life spanning 81 years of the 20th century. Those of us who are older need to realize that we have a generation of younger people now for whom Carl is a historical figure rather than any longer a contemporary one. We've got a generation who, for the most part, never met him, in many cases have never even heard of him, and my concern is that if we don't learn from the past, we may be condemned to repeat it. You all ought to be just a little interested in history because you're making it right now. What was present when I said that is past already and has become a part of history. Past and present are the same rope. And we've come up now to the place where we're getting close to our part of the rope. If somebody pulled on that rope 50 years ago, you may still feel that pull now. And Carl pulled our rope. That's why we need to talk about it. I believe there's a lesson to be learned from our experience with Carl, and that's my sole reason for dwelling here for a little while. Because in the church, we never have new problems. We just have the same old problems recurring, recirculating over and over again. And knowing that this can be a sensitive area for us to go into, because many of you knew Carl, let me just take full responsibility for the fact that I am mentioning him. We've got three elders of the congregation here who can easily shut me down if they choose to. They'd be perfectly within their right to do that. But I don't want to say anything that's offensive to anyone. I just think this needs to be touched on. This is a part of our history. People don't seem to mind when you say something about Luther or Campbell, but we didn't know them. And when we talk about somebody that some of us knew, it's a little bit different because it's more personal, and that's understandable. And I do understand it, believe me. I knew Carl. I always liked him personally, but I could never follow him. And that's the issue that we have to talk about. Brother Ketcherside was a rather unusual man. It's just necessary to talk a little bit about his life and then draw a conclusion. We've had experience here. What experience does is to let us see the end of things. You not only see the initial action, but then you see the result from that action 20 or 30 or 50 years later. You not only see the attitude of the moment, but you see the consequences. You can learn by your own experience, and that's good. But if you could learn by the experiences of others, that's much better. That's why we're given the book of Ecclesiastes. That's why Paul says that the experiences that ancient Israel went through were written for our learning, upon whom the ends of the earth are come. So a sense of the past helps us to avoid the failures of the past. And that's why I'm looking back. Carl Ketcherside seems to have been from childhood looked upon as somewhat of a prodigy. He was the oldest of six children, born over on the other side of Missouri in the lead belt there. And he took the lead in everything from infancy, it seems. He always read everything he could get his hands on and remembered a good deal of it. Wilford Landis's father, Carl Landis, told me one time that they didn't spank Carl enough when he was a boy. They lived in the same area up north. I don't know if that's true or not. What I do know is that when he was baptized into Christ at the age of 12 up in Illinois where his family had moved, and he began to do some speaking around in the immediate area where he lived. In his early and middle teens, he held meetings further and further away from home. That's when he first came down here, when he was known as the boy preacher. Carl was enthusiastic, energetic, and extremely fluent, and began to develop a great reputation. When he graduated from high school in Topeka, Kansas in 1925, he was a debater. The yearbook, the year he graduated, said, "Beware, girls, he cometh with his oratory to win thee." Another page, speaking of incongruity, said, "Has anyone ever seen Carl Ketcherside unable to talk?" Many people have said that he was the most eloquent speaker they ever heard. He got married at the age of 20, soon had a couple of children, and about the age of 26, he was appointed to the eldership over here at Nevada, Missouri. The Bible says, "Not a novice, lest being lifted up with pride he fall into the condemnation of the devil." I want to get off on the subject of how old an elder should be, but it seems to me that 26 is awfully young for the eldership. And that may be part of the package we're talking about here. It has been widely reported that when Carl was young, his father, William Ketcherside, who had become an evangelist, said that Carl will split the church someday, that he felt that he wasn't going to be stable. Now, I didn't hear him say that, but I have heard that widely reported. It would seem that the seeds were there to be seen. Here was a young man who, by his own later admission, was thought more highly of himself than he ought to think. Here was a man who was one of us, but when he stood before us, he didn't always really seem to be one of us. Here was a man who had the ability to make people think he was a great man, and also to make people think that they were important to him. It became a part of him. He grew up this way. And if you're important to a great man, then you must be pretty important too. So he made people feel good. He called everybody by name and knew how to glad hand and backslap people. He had the ability to aggrandize circumstances and people until they sounded a lot rosier than they really were. I could give you dozens of examples of this. Everything I'm saying is on the basis of testimony and corroborative evidence. I'll give you an example of something my father told me, and I didn't judge my time very well. I'm running out here. I need to get to my point. But just one example here. Carl had taught at 59th and Kenwood the young people's class, which my dad was a part of. He had my dad read a scripture during that class. And after my dad read this scripture, Carl said, "I have seldom heard the Word of God read more clearly and more meaningfully and in such a fine way." My dad was a very young man, but he remembered that years later to tell me about it, that this was an impressive thing. Kenny Morgan told me that before he moved out to Oregon, Carl told him about the opportunities out there, the fields are white unto harvest, the time is ripe to push back the borders of Zion. Kenneth got out there, he said he wasn't that way out of here at all. But Carl was an enthusiast. He was always emphasizing the bright side of things. He was a tremendous exhorter who could really stir people up and get them moving. He was a salesman who could have sold snow to the Eskimos, and he certainly could sell himself. They say that in his heyday, he could play on the emotions of an audience like a violin. They'd be laughing one minute and crying the next. So he became a leader in the Brotherhood, slowly transformed in the minds of many into the leader of the Brotherhood. By his personality, by his debates, by his Bible readings, and by the paper, the Missouri Mission Messenger, later shortened to Mission Messenger, that he started when he moved to St. Louis. I wish I had kept more time for this. I'm sorry. I just need to come down to the point here about the mantle. The idea is that Alexander Campbell had the mantle of the church and that this was passed down to Benjamin Franklin, who passed it down to Daniel Sommer, who passed it down to Carl. I don't have time to read you the documentation for that. But in Carl's first debate of any moment was over here in 1937 at Ozark, in the Ozark Community Center, that beautiful downtown building, which I understand now is closed. But back then it was new, been built by WPA money coming out of the Depression. And it was in 1937, Carl debated Rue Porter, who was 20 years his senior and had 25 debates under his belt. It's Carl's first debate. He's 28 years old, and it's on the subject of institutionalism for 4 nights. There were hundreds and hundreds of people there every night. It was covered by the newspaper in Springfield. Big deal at the time. And it was said after that Rue Porter refused to ever debate Carl again. Anyway, this idea of the mantle came up in that debate. I didn't get to where I needed to get. The bottom line on this is that we need to be very careful if we see somebody in the church accumulating power. It's ironic that Carl, who taught so much against the one-man minister system, where one man seems to have the control of a congregation, with his pen and with his voice, was virtually for a while controlling the Brotherhood, or it would appear attempting to control the Brotherhood. That's an ironic thing. We just need to watch it if we see this type of thing happening again. Remember that we've seen it before, and we need to develop a sense of humor or a sense of proportion, whatever it is. Here's the important point about this. It was not Carl who made himself into what he became. We did that. The Brotherhood made Carl into what he became, and the Brotherhood paid a heavy price. We need to learn from that and not let that type of thing happen again. I don't know of anybody now who's trying to do that, and I'm glad that we're not. But we may see this again in the future. It would be natural for that to occur, and it needs to be dealt with on every level when it begins to occur. I'm sorry that I didn't leave more time for that, and especially for perhaps some discussion of that. But I submit that for your consideration, and you have a 15-minute break.